living room. For a few moments, the only sound was the thump and swish of feet trotting up the worn wooden steps of his home. Lee's aide, Charles Marshall, went in, followed soon thereafter by one of Grant's aides, and then Lee himself. Lee, resplendent in his magnificent crisp gray uniform and with his engraved sword at his side, sat down in the parlor at a small wooden table inside enemy territory and in painful silence waited. Half an hour later, at 1:30 p.m., came a new sound, the trot of Union horses. With his queer, stumbling stride, U.S. Grant entered. He was swordless, dressed in a private's muddy shirt, his boots and trousers were splattered with mud, his cheeks were pink, his blue eyes clear, his hair dark. For the first time in nearly two decades, in this square, somewhat cramped room, the two generals would see each other in the flesh, face to face. On this day, there would be no rituals, no pageantry, no excessive ministrations. Rather, it would be their destiny to dictate the fate of their two armies and set down the outlines for what would one day become their common country. Lee rose to his feet. The two men shook hands, and then they took their respective seats, 8 feet apart. About a dozen of Grant's staff officers positioned themselves quietly around the parlor, a room that now pulsed with hidden excitement, awaiting the dazzling piece of theater about to be played out, even as it was suffused with Lee's private anguish. For his part, Lee's face revealed nothing. "What General Lee's feelings were, I do not know," Grant would later write. "As he was a man of such dignity, with an impassible face, his feelings were entirely concealed from my observation." Interestingly, it was Grant, however, not Lee, who exhibited nervous tension, even a sense of awe at the occasion, as he did his best to put Lee at ease with a friendly overture. "I met you once before, General Lee, while we were serving in Mexico, when you came over from General Scott's headquarters to visit Garland's brigade, to which I then belonged. I have always remembered your appearance, and I think I should have recognized you anywhere." "Yes," acknowledged Lee, "I know I met you on that occasion, and I've often thought of it and tried to recollect how you looked, but I have never been able to recall a single feature." The conversation momentarily lagged, but then Grant continued nervously to chat. "Our conversation grew so friendly," he recalled, "that I almost forgot the object of our meeting," until Lee finally interrupted him. "I suppose, General Grant, that the object of our present meeting is fully understood," he said quietly. "I asked to see you to ascertain upon what terms you would receive the surrender of my army." Grant replied, "The terms I propose are those stated substantially in my letter of yesterday. That is, the officers and men surrendered are to be paroled and disqualified from taking up arms again until properly exchanged, and all arms, ammunition, and supplies to be delivered up as captured property." Lee nodded. Whatever he felt at that exact moment, Grant's words would have eased his worst fears of the morning. "Those are," Lee now said, "about the conditions I expected would be proposed." "Yes," Grant reassured him. "I think our correspondence indicated pretty clearly the action that would be taken at our meeting, and I hope it may lead to a general suspension of hostilities and be the means of preventing any further loss of life." Grant continued on this theme, happily talking of the future, of reunion, and the prospects of peace. For his part, Lee said nothing, perhaps feeling uncertain, even slightly stunned. From West Point, through his 36 years of military service, Lee had become intimately acquainted with all the arts of war, save one, surrender. But after a bit, the Confederate general found his voice and interrupted again. "I presume, General Grant, we have both carefully considered the proper steps to be taken, and I would suggest that you commit to writing the terms you have proposed so that they may be formally acted upon." "Very well," Grant said. "I will write them out." Grant, lighting not his trademark cigar but a pipe, directed that his order book be laid before him. He began writing steadily, halting only to glance at the sword on Lee's side. After conferring with his secretary about the terms as written, including some editing here, some clarification there, Grant then rose and, rather than have an aide deliver it, personally handed the book to Lee. Only several feet, it was, ultimately, a journey of timeless consequence. The order book passed from Grant's hands to Lee's. Now, Lee brushed aside the two brass candlesticks and some other items that were on the table, then took the book before him and opened it. With all eyes on him fixed in an almost reverential gaze, it became time for Lee to master his own nerves. He fidgeted, pulling his spectacles out of his pocket, withdrawing his handkerchief, carefully wiping his glasses. He fidgeted some more, suddenly crossing his legs and just as suddenly making a show of unconsciously adjusting his spectacles. Then the fidgeting ended and he began to read, attentively, slowly, carefully. This was no mere parchment of paper, that he knew all too well. It was a veritable exchange of the crozier of authority, the words that would eventually rewrite the rules and the realities of a new country. Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia, April 9th, 1865, General R. E. Lee, Commander, CSA. General, in accordance with the substance of my letter to you of the 8th instant, I propose to receive the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia on the following terms, to wit, rolls of all the officers and men to be made duplicate, one copy to be given to an officer designated by me, the other to be retained by such an officer or officers as you may designate, the officers to give their individual paroles not to take up arms against the government of the United States until properly. Lee paused, abruptly looked up to Grant, and said, after the words, until properly, the word exchanged seems to be omitted. You doubtless intended to use that word? Why, yes, Grant said, surprised. In fact, these words, until properly, were themselves added only belatedly. I thought I had put in the word exchanged. I presume it had been omitted inadvertently, and with your permission, I will mark where it should be inserted. Certainly, Grant replied. Lee felt around in his pocket for a pencil. One of Grant's aides, Horace Porter, supplied one. Nervously twirling and tapping his pencil, Lee read on. Exchanged, and each company or regimental commander to sign a like parole for the men of their commands. The arms, artillery, and public property to be parked and stacked and returned over to the officer appointed by me to receive them. This will not embrace the sidearms of the officers, nor their private horses or baggage. This done, each officer and man will be allowed to return to their homes, not to be disturbed by the United States authority so long as they observe their parole and the laws in force where they may reside. Very respectfully, U.S. Grant, Lieutenant General. For the first time since the meeting began, Lee's expression brightened. Now the terms were fixed in writing, and they were as generous as could be expected. His men would not be penned as prisoners of war. They would not be paraded ignominiously through northern streets. And, most importantly, they would not be prosecuted for treason. Looking over to Grant, he said somewhat warmly, "This will have a very happy effect upon my army." Now it was Grant who wanted to move things along. "Unless you have some suggestions to make in regard to the form in which I have stated the terms, I will have a copy of the letter made in ink and sign it." For one brief moment, Lee seemed frozen and hesitated slowly. He was searching for the right words. "There is one thing I should like to mention," he interjected. "The cavalrymen and artillerists own their own horses in our army. Its organization in this respect differs from that of the United States. I should like to understand whether these men will be permitted to retain their horses." Lee's reference to the armies of the two countries apparently startled some of the Federals. To the remarkable, almost surreal scene, it injected a piquant note of Civil War reality. But an unfazed Grant didn't miss a beat in responding. Indeed, in a gentle way, he would now make it clear who was dictating the terms to whom. "You will find that the terms as written do not allow this. Only the officers are permitted to take their private property." Lee's eyes again painfully scanned the second page of the surrender document. "No," he said sadly, his face subtly registering disappointment. "I see the terms do not allow it. That is clear." It was an awkward moment, and Grant clearly sensed that his next words carried authority far beyond this room and far beyond the seemingly minor subject they dealt with. What followed next, in all its simplicity, was one of his boldest strokes. "Well, the subject is quite new to me," he explained. "Of course, I did not know that any private soldiers owned their animals. But I think we have fought the last battle of the war. I sincerely hope so." Presuming that most of the men were small farmers and would need their horses to plant a crop, he added, "I will arrange it this way." Lee was listening carefully. "I will not change the terms as now written, but I will instruct the officers I shall appoint to receive the paroles to let all the men who claim to own a horse or a mule take the animals home with them to their little farms. This will have the best possible effect upon the men," Lee immediately answered, now returning Grant's gracious gesture with the words the Union general wanted to hear. "It will be very gratifying and will do much toward conciliating our people." The surrender was promptly given to Grant's aide, Eli Parker, who borrowed ink from Lee's secretary to copy it. Marshall, Lee's aide, in turn borrowed paper from Grant's staff to write out the Confederate general's reply. "General, I have received your letter of this date containing the terms of surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia as proposed by you. As they are substantially the same as those expressed in your letter of the 8th instant, they are accepted. I will proceed to designate the proper officers to carry the stipulations into effect. Very respectfully, your obedient servant, R. E. Lee, General." Lee had one bit of additional business he wanted to conclude with Grant. Explaining first that he had more than 1,000 federal prisoners whom he could not feed, he added glumly, "Indeed, I have nothing for my own men." Without hesitation, Grant proposed sending rations for the 25,000 men across the lines. "Was that enough?" he asked. "Plenty," Lee said. "In abundance, I assure you." After the two men had signed the preliminary papers, Grant proceeded to introduce Lee to his staff. As he shook hands with Grant's military secretary, Eli Parker, a Seneca Indian, Lee stared for a moment at Parker's dark features and finally said, "I am glad to see one real American here." "If this account is true," Parker responded to the general, "we are all Americans." As the completed letters of surrender were being copied, Grant again rushed to fill the silence, this time explaining why he was not wearing his dress sword. In fact, years later, Grant would admit to being embarrassed at wearing no sword and dirty boots. When the letters were ready, the acceptance hand-signed by Lee was given to Grant's secretary. Then Lee somberly shook hands with Grant, gave a courtly bow to the other officers in the room, and left. By now, a crowd of anxious sightseers was clustered around the front porch to catch a glimpse of the Confederate general. His face flushed a deep crimson. Lee emerged onto the porch, carrying his hat and gloves. Here he paused, put on his hat, and slowly drew on his gloves, absent-mindedly gazing out into the field beyond. Once, then twice, then a third time, he unconsciously balled his left hand and pumped the fist into the palm of his right. Still seemingly oblivious to his surroundings, he automatically returned the salute given to him by the Union officers crowding around the porch, then descended the stairs. Now, as if drawing himself back from a daze, he glanced deliberately in one direction and then the next. Not seeing his horse, he called out in a half-choked and more than half-tired voice, "Orderly! Orderly!" The horse was brought around. The general smoothed Traveler's forelocks as the orderly fit the bridle, then with a slow, exhausted tug, pulled himself on the horse, letting out a long, deep sigh, almost a groan. By then, Grant had walked out on the porch, too, and as Lee rode past him, their eyes met. Each silently lifted his hat to the other. On the porch and in the yard, countless other Federals also returned the gesture. In no small measure, this one poignant moment captured the spirit of Appomattox more than the words ever written about that day. But this didn't stop the participants from trying to give voice to the event, including Grant himself. "I felt sad and depressed," Grant later explained of this moment, "at the downfall of a foe who had fought so long and valiantly and had suffered so much for a cause, though that cause was, I believe, one of the worst for which a people ever fought." Two of Grant's aides put it thus, "This will live in history," one wrote. Another commented, "Such a scene only happens once in centuries." Euphoria quickly spread through the Federal camp. General Meade, both arms in the air, shouted with all his voice, "It's all over, boys! Lee surrendered! It's all over now!" The air was quickly blanketed with whatever the men could hurl. Hats, boots, coats, knapsacks, cartridge boxes, shelter tents, shirts, canteens, and haversacks. Huge bearded men embraced and kissed like schoolgirls. Grown men cried. Sobs and moans filled the valley. Bands struck up Old Hundredth, the Star-Spangled Banner, and Marching Along. And then Federal artillery started to fire salutes. All this, however, irritated Grant. He knew there would be plenty of time for rejoicing, but today was not it. He sternly ordered them to stop. "The Confederates were now our prisoners," he later explained, "and we did not want to exult over their downfall." For one thing, Grant was acutely aware that on this day, what had occurred was the surrender of one army to another, not of one government to another. In this sense, Meade was distinctly not correct. It wasn't yet all over. The war was still very much on. There were a number of potentially troubling rebel commanders in the field, and there were still some 175,000 other Confederates under arms elsewhere, one half in scattered garrisons and the rest in the three remaining rebel armies. What mattered now was laying the groundwork for persuading Lee's fellow armies to join in his surrender, and also for reunion, the urgent matter of making the nation whole again. Thus, it should be no great surprise that there was a curious restraint in Grant's tepid victory message passed on to Washington. Dated 4:30 p.m., April 9, in address to Secretary of War Stanton, the message simply stated, "General Lee surrendered the Army of Northern Virginia this afternoon on terms proposed by myself." Robert E. Lee had done his duty and, however heartbroken, was prepared to do his duty still. Having devoted himself to winning the war, until the bitter end, he was now beginning the transition to an equally fervent commitment, reuniting the two halves of the divided country. As he slowly rode back to his camp, some 15 minutes away, advanced soldiers began to shout, "General, are we surrendered?" Lee struggled for words to express his sense of despair and came up short. He was speechless. But soon, two solid walls of men began to line the road, and when he came into view, they began to cheer wildly. At the sound and the sight, tears started to roll in the general's eyes, and his men, too, began to weep. Each group began in the same way, with cheers, and ended in the same way, with sobs, all the way to the quarters, observed one Confederate. Disheartened, bearded men collapsed on their knees, covered their faces, and wept like children. When Lee raised his head and waved his hat in his hand, the stoic reserve of officers also broke down, and they sat on their horses and openly cried aloud. With their commander gently riding by, men drew their hands sadly over the sides of Traveler, while one old rebel called out, summing up the feeling of all the men, "I love you just as well as ever, General." But not all the soldiers cheered in defeat. One private fell to the ground and shouted, "Blow, Gabriel, blow! My God, let him blow! I am ready to die." Another muttered darkly, "No Yankee will ever shoot us." A private swore he would never be surrendered, and shouldering his knapsack, ready to leave for North Carolina to join Joe Johnston. And one of Lee's generals and a prominent former Virginia governor would soon remark, when asked about reconciliation, "There is rancor in our hearts which you little dream of. We hate you, sir." But with his eyes fixed on a line between his horse's ears, his gaze straight ahead, his cheeks still damp with tears, Lee was determined to curb such sentiments. In a day marked by simple eloquence and simple touches, Lee ended with one that more than equaled all the rest. Upon his return, a crowd of weeping soldiers was waiting in front of the general's tent. When Lee arrived, he paused thoughtfully, then spoke up. "Boys," he told his men, "I have done the best I could for you. My heart is too full to say more." But before he turned and silently mouthed goodbye and God bless you all, and then disappeared into his tent alone, he uttered this: "Go home now, and if you make as good citizens as you have soldiers, you will do well, and I shall always be proud of you." Before dusk settled, a light drizzle began to fall on the land. The question that forever must be asked is this: how did a general, who declared we must all be prepared to die at our posts, and men who in their final battle at Sailor's Creek clawed and charged and even bit their enemy with a pure, savage fury, then lay down their guns and begin to open their hearts to the other side? In retrospect, there seems to be an air of inevitability about the 3 hours in a Wilmer McLean house in Appomattox and the process it set in motion, a belief that all this seems so natural, the gracious meeting of two generals, a surrender conducted smoothly without a touch of rancor. And there is a pervading sense that the reconciliation that followed was near flawless, that the men were gabbing maniacally with each other, emptying their guns and unshouldering their holsters, backslapping and laughing, suddenly racing headlong toward a peaceful coexistence. To be sure, late that afternoon, Union soldiers drifted into the Confederate camp, and soon knots of blue and gray-clad men dotted the hills around Appomattox Courthouse. Bullets were indeed replaced by backslaps. The rebel yell with a hearty southern drawl, war fervor with the first hints of war nostalgia, unbridled hatred with nascent relief, and, by the next day, West Point mini-reunions were even breaking out at the McLean farmhouse. But all this is deceiving, of course, a view arising conveniently out of hindsight. Appomattox was not preordained. There were no established rules or well-worn script. If anything, retribution had been the larger and longer precedent. So, if these moments teemed with hope, and they did, it was largely due to two men who rose to the occasion, to Grant's and Lee's respective actions. One general, magnanimous in victory, the other, gracious and equally dignified in defeat, the two of them, for their own reasons and in their own ways, fervently interested in beginning the process to bind up the wounds of the last 4 years. And yes, if paradoxically these were among Lee's finest hours, and they were, so too were they Grant's greatest moments. But we also delude ourselves if we think the process initiated at Appomattox was the summary end. Indeed, it was but the beginning of a long, arduous, and still tenuous course, one that could still veer off track in the weeks ahead. The next day, it was still raining when Lee issued his final order to his troops, known simply as General Orders No. 9. After 4 years of arduous service, marked by unsurpassed courage and fortitude, the Army of Northern Virginia has been compelled to yield to overwhelming numbers and resources. I need not tell the brave survivors of so many hard-fought battles, who have remained steadfast to the last, that I have consented to the result from no distrust of them. But feeling that valor and devotion could accomplish nothing that would compensate for the loss that must have attended the continuance of the contest, I determined to avoid the useless sacrifice of those whose past services have endeared them to their countrymen. By the terms of the agreement, officers and men can return to their homes and remain until exchanged. You will take with you the satisfaction that proceeds from the consciousness of duty faithfully performed, and I earnestly pray that a merciful God will extend to you his blessing and protection. With an increasing admiration of your constancy and devotion to your country, and a grateful remembrance of your kind and generous considerations for myself, I bid you all an affectionate farewell. For generations, General Orders No. 9 would be recited in the South with the same pride as the Gettysburg Address was learned in the North. It is marked less by its soaring prose, the language is in fact rather prosaic, but by what it does say, bringing his men affectionate words of closure, and, just as importantly, what it doesn't say. Nowhere does it exhort his men to continue this struggle. Nowhere does it challenge the legitimacy of the Union government that had forced their surrender. Nowhere does it fan the flames of discontent. In fact, Lee pointedly struck out a draft paragraph that could have been construed to do just that. Of almost equal import that day was a surprise message delivered to Lee at 10 that morning. Grant was waiting at the Confederate picket lines. Lee immediately rode out to see him. Once again, Grant sought to use Lee's influence to induce the surrender of other Confederate armies. And in so doing, Grant believed that he was on a mission from Abraham Lincoln. In their crucial City Point meeting on the River Queen in late March, and as recently as a week earlier in Petersburg, Lincoln had expressed his wish to let the South down easy. His goal was a true Union, not a victorious North harshly punishing a vanquished and treasonous foe. Grant thus sought to push his former antagonist into the politics of dissolving the Confederacy, even asking, when he surely could have demanded, if Lee would go to Washington to meet with Lincoln. Well versed in war, Grant was pressing the tactics of peace. The entire Confederacy would look to the slightest gesture, to every word, every motion that Lee would make. Grant realized that even for a defeated General Lee, his fame eclipsed his rank. One statement from the aging patriarch could sway the entire South in the crucial weeks and months to come. But Lee, the military man, demurred, saying that such moves were impossible. He could not formally urge other surrenders without conferring with civilian authorities, namely President Davis. Still, Grant's pleas were not in vain. Equally significant, Lee did pledge to do this. He would, he said, devote his whole efforts to pacifying the country and bringing the people back to the Union. That was good enough for Grant. He promised he would carry Lee's message to Lincoln immediately. If the spirit of Appomattox was codified on paper on the 9th and reinforced between the two commanding generals on the 10th, it was enshrined in the memories of the fighting men on the 12th. That day marked the formal surrender of Lee's army. Above all, this surrender defied millenniums of tradition in which rebellions typically ended in yet a greater shedding of blood. As Henry Steele Commager and Samuel Eliot Morrison properly remind us, one need only recall the harsh suppression of the peasants' revolt in Germany in the 16th century, or the ravages of Alva during the Dutch Rebellion, or the terrible punishments inflicted on the Irish by Cromwell, and then on the Scots after Culloden, or the blood-stained vengeance exacted during the French Revolution, or the terrible retribution executed during the Napoleonic Restoration, or the horrible retaliation imposed during the futile Chinese Rebellion in the mid-19th century. And of course, in our own time, there are the incalculable horrors of the Russian, Nazi, and Spanish revolutions and civil wars. And, both in and outside the industrialized world, the more recent blood-stained retribution in Cambodia, Yugoslavia, and Rwanda. But on this April day in 1865, there was instead the formal stacking of arms and the last somber folding of battle flags. Men were not hanged, they were saluted. They were not jailed, they were honored. They were not humiliated or beaten, they were embraced. Some of this was by design, much of it occurred totally spontaneously. All of it mattered. It was Grant who had insisted upon a formal surrender, one that the participants would never forget, although, in typical fashion, he ordered that it be kept simple. The two sides met along the stage road at the eastern edge of the village. Behind them stretched rolling farmland, groves of trees, and grass-covered hills. The Union officer in charge of the ceremony was Joshua L. Chamberlain, the fighting professor from Bowdoin College in Maine, who had won a Medal of Honor for his valor at Gettysburg's Little Round Top. Now a brigadier general, he had been wounded twice since then and was still in pain from a bullet that had almost killed him during this final campaign. Leading the 28,000 or so Confederates was Major General John B. Gordon, one of Lee's hardest fighters who had been shot through the face and wounded four more times during his service to the Confederacy, and who now commanded Stonewall Jackson's old corps. This was the last Confederate advance of the Army of Northern Virginia, and it was carried out with stunning precision. Chamberlain would never forget it. "On they came, with the old swinging root step and swaying battle flags, crowded so thick, by thinning out of men, that the whole column seemed crowned with red. In the van, the proud Confederate ensign, before us in proud humiliation stood the embodiment of manhood. Men whom neither toils and sufferings, nor the fact of death, nor disaster, nor hopelessness, could bend from their resolve. Standing before us now, thin, worn, and famished, but erect, and with eyes looking level into ours, waking memories that bound us together as no other bond. Without having planned it, and without any official sanction, Chamberlain suddenly gave the order for Union soldiers to carry arms as a sign of their deepest mark of military respect. A bugle call instantly rang out. All along the road, Union soldiers raised their muskets to their shoulders, the salute of honor. At the sound of the machine-like snap of arms, Chamberlain recalled, General Gordon started, then wheeled his horse, facing me, touching him gently with the spur so that the animal slightly reared, and, as he wheeled, horse and rider made one motion. The horse's head swung down with a graceful bow, and General Gordon dropped his sword point to his toe in salutation. and as he did, the veterans in blue gave a soldierly salute to those vanquished heroes, a token of respect from Americans to Americans. Gordon ordered his men to answer in kind, honor answering honor. And then, Chamberlain wrote, on our part, not a sound of trumpet more, nor roll of drum, not a cheer, nor word, nor whisper or vain glorying, nor motion of man, but an awed stillness rather, and breath-holding, as if it were the passing of the dead. The formal surrender continued for 7 full hours, encompassing not just some 28,000 men, but over 100,000 pounds of arms, munitions, and colors that had been carried across some of the bloodiest battle lines. Chamberlain described it thus, as each successive division masks our own, it halts. The men face inward toward us across the road, 12 feet away, then carefully dress their line. They fix bayonets, stack arms, then hesitatingly remove cartridge boxes and lay them down. Lastly, reluctantly, with agony of expression, they tenderly fold their flags, battle-worn and torn, blood-stained, heart-holding colors, and lay them down. And finally, he added, from his own heart, how could we help falling on our knees, all of us together, and praying God to pity and forgive us all? Yet for all the promise of this day, as the Army of Northern Virginia slowly disbanded and began heading home, dire questions remained. Would the spirit of Appomattox infuse the rest of the tattered Confederacy, still prepared to fight and die for the Stars and Bars? Would Lee's rejection of guerrilla warfare prevail over Davis's embrace? Would the Confederates, some of whom were already scattered throughout the country like partridges and rabbits, take to the hills in an organized manner and fight for weeks, months, or years? Or would they now follow Lee's example and become good citizens? Would a last apocalyptic engagement still be fought in the deeper reaches of the South, with more lives lost, more men killed? And could the country finally become reunited, a true union, at long last not simply a loose collection of states, but a nation? These were hardly idle concerns, as a weary Abraham Lincoln in Washington well knew. One stubborn fact still clung fast. The war was not quite over. 2 state capitals remained in Confederate hands. Lee had surrendered only a fraction of the Southern soldiers under arms, and daunting obstacles remained. Even Mary Custis Lee had this to say, "The end is not yet. Richmond is not the Confederacy. General Lee is not the Confederacy." In truth, there was still Joe Johnson's army in North Carolina that had to be subdued, and a host of other extant smaller armies. Richard Taylor's, spread across Alabama, Mississippi, and eastern Louisiana. E. Kirby Smith's, just west of the Mississippi. The forces of Colonel John S. Rest in Peace Ford in Texas. And the Indian armies in the far west, under Brigadier General Stand Watty. And there were still John Mosby in Virginia and Nathan Bedford Forrest, his men scattered across Mississippi, Alabama, and Tennessee, and an array of other smaller guerrilla groups. And, of course, there was the Confederate government on the run. In a sense, Lincoln knew that final victory would come in a matter of time. But then, time could be a bitter enemy as well as a good friend. How much longer would it be? 1 week? 3? A month? 6 months? Throughout history, such brief time spans have been long enough to form military alliances, declare and win wars, unseat dynasties, plunge countries into unmitigated chaos, or abruptly shift the momentum of entire conflicts themselves. Indeed, there was one more sobering fact, the grim aphorism that in matters of war and peace, the actions of one man alone could radically alter the whole constellation of events, that history could abruptly shift and turn, that the euphoria and inevitability of one day could dissolve into tragedy and disaster by the next, which was precisely what would happen. Part 3, April 15, 1865. Chapter 5, The Unraveling. "I think we are near the end at last," Lincoln cautiously told his Secretary of State when the sun had set on the events of Palm Sunday, April 9, 1865. Outside, the people were far less restrained. Fruitful and teeming with hope, the North had already been celebrating heartily since the fall of Richmond. That day merited a whopping 900-gun salute. After Appomattox, 500 guns again boomed throughout the city, shattering windows across the way from the White House and Lafayette Square and sending a thrilling shockwave down the streets. The people themselves, from Georgetown to Capitol Hill, Judiciary Square to Center Market, Negro Hill to Swamp Poodle, Rock Creek Park to the fine estates of Harewood and Calorama and the far-off suburbs north of Washington, have been delirious with joy. For the better part of this week, the jubilation has been everywhere. Bonfires burn on every corner. Flags snap festively in the wind. Normally dour men stomp their feet and wave their arms. Children scamper about, chanting and cheering. Where Richmond is a dreary welter of burned-out buildings, dank boarding houses, and scattered debris, of recalcitrant Southerners and occupying soldiers, Washington reeks of one endless round of festivities. Lawn fetes, bazaars, wild saloon gatherings, smokers, parties, torchlight parades, and theatricals. And most of all, the people are hungering for speeches, above all from the president. "Speech!" a crowd of some 3,000 cries out at the White House on Monday evening. Then once more, "Speech!" as though it were a simple one-word cheer, an antiphon, echoed and re-echoed by the beaming, tearful, exultant Unionists who rejoiced in the ecstatic evidence that their sacrifices had not been in vain. But Abraham Lincoln curiously puts them off, instead promising to deliver an address on Tuesday night. Oddly enough, only Lincoln, in his exhausted condition, seems strangely immune to the intoxicating glow of impending military victory. But why? Since the stunning news of Appomattox, he should be relishing the splendid vindication of sticking to his guns over the last 4 years, of finally twitting his enemies and his critics, and huddling with his aides and closest friends in enjoying the moment. To be sure, there has been a striking change in his mood since Lee's surrender. For those who have seen him in the past few days, he is like a different man. His face is shining. His conversations are exhilarating. His whole appearance is marvelously changed. But others notice something else. He is still so exhausted that one newspaper, the New York Tribune, urgently pleads that his energies must be spared if he is to complete his second term. And to some, he is almost at loose ends. He hasn't been sleeping well, troubled by insomnia, and haunted by bizarre and ghoulish dreams. He is afflicted with fierce headaches. He is 30 pounds underweight. One evening, aides notice that he is grave and pale, even visibly disturbed. Mary Lincoln observes how dreadful solemn he is, and he is beset by dark thoughts. Earlier that week, along the James River near City Point, he and Mary had strolled through an old country graveyard. "You will survive me," he inexplicably muttered to her. "When I am gone, lay my remains in some quiet place like this." Ironically, though, it is one of his own dreams, in particular, that has most unnerved him. One evening this week, Lincoln pulls Mary aside, as well as several others in the White House, and confesses, "I had a dream the other night, which has haunted me ever since." His morose tone is too much for the First Lady. She cries out, "You frighten me! What is the matter?" Lincoln pulls back, suddenly recoiling. He says faintly that perhaps he had done wrong in even mentioning the dream. But then, strangely enough, he continues, frankly admitting, "Somehow the thing has got the better of me." "What is it, then?" Mary asks urgently. "What has so gotten possession of him?" Lincoln again pauses, then begins. "About 10 days ago, I retired very late," he says. "I had been waiting for important dispatches from the front. I could not have been long in bed when I fell into a slumber, for I was weary. I soon began to dream." As Lincoln is speaking, his tone shifts, becoming at once sad and solemn. "There seemed to be a death-like stillness about me. Then I heard subdued sobs, as if a number of people were weeping. I thought I left my bed and wandered downstairs. There the silence was broken by the same pitiful sobbing, but the mourners were invisible. I went from room to room. No living person was in sight, but the same mournful sounds of distress met me as I passed along. It was light in all the rooms. Every object was familiar to me. But where were all the people who were grieving, as if their hearts would break? I was puzzled and alarmed. What could be the meaning of all this? Determined to find the cause of a state of things so mysterious and shocking, I kept on until I arrived in the East Room, which I entered. There I was met with a sickening surprise. Before me was a catafalque, on which rested a corpse wrapped in funeral vestments. Around it were stationed soldiers who were acting as guards, and there was a throng of people, some gazing mournfully upon the corpse whose face was covered, others weeping pitifully. "Who is dead in the White House?" I demanded of one of the soldiers. "The president," was the answer. "He was killed by an assassin." Then came a loud burst of grief from the crowd. "That is horrid," Mary cries out this time. "I wish you had not told it." "Well," Lincoln declares calmly, "it is only a dream, Mary. Let us say no more about it." There is a moment's hesitation. The room falls silent. Guests accustomed to Lincoln's humor don't know what to say. For his part, Lincoln can now see that his listeners are just as frightened as the First Lady. He rushes to fill the void with a light, reassuring, almost frivolous tone. He jokes to his bodyguard, big, strapping Ward Hill layman, "For a long time you have been trying to keep somebody, the Lord knows who, from killing me. Don't you see how it will turn out? In this dream," he continues, announcing in jest, "it is not me but some other fellow that was killed. It seems that his ghostly assassin tried his hand on someone else." Layman says nothing, nor does Mary. Lincoln grows serious for a moment, then murmurs, his voice probably a near whisper, "Well, let it go. I think the Lord in his own good time and way will work this out all right." But in the chill early morning of Good Friday, April 14, Lincoln wakes refreshed around 7 a.m. and in a good mood. It is a rare occurrence, and he takes it as a good omen. Last night there were no nightmares, no haunting visages, no frantic worries about ending the war and negotiating the foundering shoals of Reconstruction. True, there has been a dream, but this time it is a heartening one. In fact, the one that has come to him before on the cusp of other major military battles. He had it on the verge of Antietam and Gettysburg, and also Vicksburg and Fort Fisher, all important Union victories. In it, he is on a phantom ship, a single indescribable vessel that moves with great rapidity through the water, racing toward a vast and indefinite shore. To Lincoln, rising on this day, it signals good news. He feels that it augurs Joe Johnson's surrender in North Carolina, thereby removing the most powerful Confederate army remaining in the field and making another large-scale rebel assault almost impossible. It speaks of peace to come, and it fills him with a visible blast of optimism. Before breakfast, he lights the fireplace in his office. By the time he has finished his morning meal, dining cozily with Mary and then joined by his son Robert, and makes his way to an 11 a.m. meeting with Grant in the cabinet. He is in great spirits, appearing more cheerful and happy than many of his secretaries had ever seen him. It is infectious. Mary Lincoln will even note that these last few days have been the happiest of her life, and Lincoln is determined that the mood will not abate. Today, Good Friday, will certainly not be spent in morbid contemplation or prayer at the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church listening to Reverend Phineas D. Gurley, or simply more fussing and fretting over the war. Today, he wants something that will make him laugh. So this evening he plans to take Mary to see the eccentric English comedy Our American Cousin. It stars the famous English actress Miss Laura Keene in her very last performance. He and Mary intend to go with General Grant and his wife, and the papers will officially announce their plans. The comedy is playing at the 10th Street Theater between E and F Streets at Ford's. In the meantime, a far more powerful drama is underway as the cabinet meeting commences. It has been simmering beneath the surface for months, and now Lincoln will confront perhaps his greatest challenge yet, to subdue the Confederate forces once and for all, while at the same time laying groundwork for the peace to follow. In short, the complex and demanding matter of a post-war America, of reintegrating the South into the Union and forging the nation anew. He calls it Reconstruction. A word that more adequately captures his spirit, however, is reconciliation. Only then, he feels, can he achieve the true union that he spoke of so eloquently at his second inaugural. Even if there are no more feverish battles, and until Johnson actually does surrender, he cannot be sure of this, further low-level fighting and bloodshed could prolong the bitterness, and in turn could tempt the Confederates to take to the countryside and continue the war in some manner. This must be avoided at all costs. He believes deeply that the rebels must be able to return to their homes and see more than desolation, see more than a hated rule of the North. Somehow, he asserts, they must be enjoined to accept citizenship in the Union again. Could they? He does not have a rigid blueprint for this, but he does have a distinct vision. There has to be a speedy return of the Confederate States into the Union on the most generous terms. Civil government must be reestablished as soon as possible. He has already instructed his Navy Secretary, Gideon Welles. There must be courts and laws and order, or society would be broken up and the disbanded armies would turn into guerrillas. And he is equally determined to undertake the process of restoring the rebellious states to their proper practical relationship with the Union. Thus, there must be, as he lectures his cabinet, no persecutions, no bloody work after the war was over, no expectations that he would take part in hanging or killing these men, even the worst of them. Thus, he castigates those in Congress who possess feelings of hate and vindictiveness, and as tartly stressed to the young French nobleman, Marquis de Chambrun, his firm resolution to stand for clemency against all opposition. Thus, while he strolled through a smoldering Richmond and was asked by the commanding general in charge, General Godfrey Weitzel, how the defeated Confederates should be treated, he offered this homespun instruction. If I were in your place, I'd let 'em up easy. Let 'em up easy. And thus his choice to make a private and unannounced stop at the home of an old Richmond friend and Confederate general, George Pickett, the man who had led the infamous Gettysburg Charge. There, he fondled Pickett's baby in his arms and whispered to the child, as the astonished mother curiously looked on, "Tell your father I will grant him a special amnesty, if he wants it, for the sake of your mother's bright eyes and your good manners." After 4 bloody years of reaching for the Confederacy's jugular, Lincoln's humanity is unchanged. This avatar of total war is a staunch advocate of a soft peace, a generous peace, a magnanimous peace, just as Grant has carried out at Appomattox. It is his River Queen doctrine writ large. So passionately does he feel about this matter that he will direly tell his cabinet today, in no uncertain words, there is no greater or more important issue before us, or any future cabinet, than Reconstruction. That too was Friday, April 14. Yet Reconstruction is complex, it is nuanced, and to later generations, almost wholly baffling and prone to being misunderstood. The popular conception is that Reconstruction was to commence at war's end. This is untrue. Actually, for Lincoln, it started not as a task to be implemented upon victory, but as a tactical measure of war itself. Since the conflict began, he had to prevent the border states themselves from slipping into rebellion. Delaware and Kentucky, for instance, still practice slavery. Seek to peel away shaky parts of the Southern coalition, govern sectors freshly captured from the South, and prevent occupied territories from falling back into the hands of our enemies. In all this, he was convinced that one of the surest means to undermine the Confederacy was by setting up loyal regimes in Southern areas almost as soon as they fell under the control of Union armies. Already, he had made piecemeal attempts to do exactly that, reorganizing federal-occupied Louisiana, Arkansas, and Tennessee, establishing military control there, then helping them to set up anti-secessionist governments loyal to Washington and committed to emancipation. In this regard, however, he was thinking far less about the status of the South after the war, although to some extent he hoped his reconstructed Louisiana would be a showcase for how the North and South could be reunited, than about measures to stop the fighting. But by April 1865, the hard questions could no longer be dodged. Now the end of the war was in sight, but the country remained divided, both in spirit and in fact. When the guns fell silent, then, what was to be done with the victory? Lincoln fretted. The matter was as vexing as the war itself. For Lincoln, Reconstruction was not so much a policy as a process. While he had outlined a specific plan in 1863 for restoring states back to the Union, a state could be readmitted if 10% of the captured voting population was willing to take an oath of loyalty to the Union and allegiance to the Emancipation Proclamation, his approach varied depending upon the circumstances and exigencies of the moment. Flexibility was the watchword. Promises of amnesty, discussions of gradual emancipation, matters like black suffrage were all up for debate. And debated they were. For all his ministrations about Reconstruction, many of Lincoln's radical Republican critics on Capitol Hill and elsewhere, those who wanted no compromise on the issues of black suffrage, black civil rights, or a harsh treatment of the South, were at best indifferent to his views and, at worst, outright hostile to them. And they included some of his own cabinet members as well. Here, the abuses and intrigues of Washington were unrelenting. In fact, more often than not, Lincoln and his Republican colleagues were at each other's throats. He had his plans, they had theirs. For starters, there were the broad philosophical questions. Was the Confederacy to be treated like a conquered, treasonous nation, a hodgepodge of nameless, shapeless territories to be carved up and remade, lex talionis, an eye for an eye, as the radicals believed? Or would it return as an equal part of the United States, Lincoln's view, in which some rebels would be innocent and others, a far smaller number, perhaps guilty of crimes? Then there were the questions of government. Who would make the crucial decisions about Reconstruction? Congress? It thought so. The president and the executive? Lincoln was adamant. A special body to be established? A compromise? And there were, of course, the unending skirmishes over specifics. How would the guilty be distinguished from the innocent? On what timetable? Under whose supervision? And naturally, what about the former slaves? But the nub of the matter was largely this. The radicals wanted to recast the entire social structure of the South, While Lincoln was principally looking to reincorporate the rebellious states back into the Union fold, absent slavery. Where they wanted full suffrage for blacks, he was far more tentative. The black vote still did not exist in most of the North, favoring the vote for very intelligent Negroes and black soldiers. Although in saying this, he was the first president ever to announce that he favored any form of Negro suffrage. Where they were looking to divide up the estates of the defeated planters, giving each black family 40 acres and a mule, Lincoln still toyed with ideas on how to compensate the whites for their loss. More than ever, he was thinking about the painful transition that the Confederacy would have to make from a slave society to a free society. And where the radicals vented progressive opinions on everything from school integration to social equality between blacks and whites and interracial marriages, Lincoln frequently remained mum. To be sure, he supported the Freedmen's Bureau to protect blacks from exploitation by their former masters. But to Lincoln, these other matters were, in his own words, nothing but pernicious abstractions, fanciful hypotheticals that only obscured the larger, more crucial issue of a search for peace. So, time and again, Lincoln straddled an uncomfortable middle. It was precarious, it was awkward, and it was probably inevitable. While he did not share the conservatives' desire to put Dixie back into the hands of the planters and commercial men who had dominated before the war, neither did he subscribe to the radicals' belief that the only true Unionists in the South were the blacks. Though he was politically isolated, often besieged between extremes, and even the underdog, his longer-term goal nonetheless remained fixed as a rock, and the war and revive the Union, which meant rebuilding and restoring the conquered South while maintaining the loyalty of white Unionists, protecting black freedoms, and controlling a rebellious white majority. It was a balancing act worthy of Houdini, and the problems were endless. No surprise, Reconstruction was repeatedly thwarted by continuing feuds and mired in endless delays, leading Lincoln to complain, "We can never finish this if we never begin it." Never was this more true than by April 1865, as a dismal impasse had been reached altogether. True, there were fleeting moments of cooperation. He and the radicals had happily collaborated on Lincoln's boldest stroke, the historic 13th Amendment abolishing slavery forever. But as it happened, the partnership largely dissolved after that. In Congress alone, Lincoln clashed with his friend, the dapper New Englander, Senator Charles Sumner. He jousted with the churlish representative, Thaddeus Stevens. He maneuvered against the blunt Ohioan, Congressman Benjamin Wade. The slurred epithets shouted against him were fierce. The hostility was often implacable and seemed to grow daily. On Lincoln's attempts to get newly elected representatives from Union-occupied Louisiana and Arkansas seated in Congress, Marylander Henry Winter Davis fulminated, "When I came to Congress 10 years ago, this was a government of law. I have lived to see it a government of personal will." When he sought to recognize a transitional Unionist regime in Louisiana, the radical abolitionists Wendell Phillips and George Luther Stearns organized a protest against him, and Lincoln was widely labeled a dictator. When he pursued his Louisiana plan nonetheless, Senator Wade and other liberals were no less cutting, castigating it as Lincoln's 7 months abortion. And when Lincoln argued that the military could help establish a civilian regime in Louisiana for safekeeping until it became a free and democratic state, pleading, "We shall sooner have the fowl by hatching the egg than by smashing it," Senator Sumner frostily snapped back, "The eggs of crocodiles can produce only crocodiles." In the end, Congress stymied all of Lincoln's cherished plans for restoring the occupied Confederate South, prompting the New York Herald to wryly note, "Sumner has kicked the pet scheme of the president down the marble steps of the Senate chamber." But, in truth, it was not just Sumner. Indeed, on February 3, 1865, when Lincoln met with the three Confederate commissioners at Hampton Roads, He had held out the carrot of compensated emancipation to the South, $400 million for the Confederate States, if only the rebels would cease their resistance to the national authority by April 1. Yet the equivocation of the Confederate commissioners was nothing compared to the stinging reply from, of all places, his own cabinet, which unanimously rebuffed him. Reeling from their vehemence, he bowed his head, folded up his papers, and chortled sheepishly, "You are all against me." His sentiment was understandable. For when the radical Republicans weren't sticking their finger in Lincoln's eye, the conservative Republicans and Democrats,